This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access shows live or as podcasts by going online to kuci.org. This is the In the Garden show produced by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I'm Chris Bonner, your Master Gardener host for the hour. Today's program is Lessons Learned from English Gardens, featuring an interview with fellow Master Gardener Sally Richards. Good morning, Sally. It's really nice to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's fun to be here.
Sally's a lifelong gardener who went through both the Master Gardener and KUCI training together, went through that together last year. Sally moved here from Michigan fairly recently and brought not only her gardening expertise, but fresh and different perspectives on gardening. Today's show is Lessons Learned from English Gardens and is inspired by a trip that Sally and a group of fellow master gardeners took last spring that included attending the world-famous Chelsea Garden Show, as well as 10 other gardeners in southern England. The Chelsea Garden Show, formerly known as the Great Spring Show, is a garden show held in May by the Royal Horticultural Society of England on the grounds in Chelsea, London. It's been going on since 1912 and is probably the most famous flower and landscape garden show in the United Kingdom and is attracts people from all over the world. Lifelong learning is a core value of Master Gardeners and travel is a fun and powerful way to learn about gardening. Our show is not a garden travel show. We want to bring ideas and perspectives from our travels to show how to incorporate these into our gardens here in Orange County. We also want to share the fun and excitement of gardening travel, hopefully to inspire you to visit botanic gardens, arboretums, garden shows and tours, be they near or far, to get inspiration for your home garden. So before we get into the specifics, Sally, give us an overview of this wonderful tour that you took.
Well, this was one of those things that as I'm getting older, I had to get my bucket list going, and this was on it. I always wanted to see the Chelsea Garden show, and along with that, we were able to see 10 different gardens in southern England, and so it was kind of a nice bus trip with fellow gardeners, and we saw a lot of English gardens that were formal and informal before we got to the garden show.
Now, when I travel, I like to do what you do and to visit different gardens when I'm out and about and traveling around to get ideas and inspirations. But one of the things that I've always, I think is fun is the combination of gardening and history that oftentimes these gardens have historical components. Was that true for the gardens you visited?
Well, you know, English gardens weren't known as English gardens way back when. They actually were developed in the 16 to 1700s. Before that, they used to just be hedgerows, and people would have their farm, and then they'd have their livestock separated. But it wasn't until people were getting more money, living in larger estates and going, gee, I really want to do something with them. And that's when the landscape architects and painters came into more prominence. And so the people that had the money said, I want to do something with the property around my house. And so that's when the original William Kent was the original person who came up with the idea of an English garden. And those were formal gardens. And we're going to talk about the differences between a formal and a cottage garden because that came later. But originally they were very structured, had hedges, and it was more for people that owned like hundreds of acres of property. And they
estates.
Yeah, big estates. And those were the ones that first originally started doing some type of organized gardening. And that's when English gardening started. But after that, after the 1700s, then some of the other people, Charles Bridgman, for example, said, you know, I really want to have more of a informal garden, some more of a cottage, and that's where cottage gardenings came from. For people who, you know, maybe didn't have a huge estate, but they really like to have flowers and they like the idea of having gardens. And so the smaller, more intimate gardens, so the cottage gardens were formed then.
So the gardening, the English gardens had their roots in aristocracy, in the rich folks on the big estates, and then it worked its way down and evolved into different kinds of English gardens, including the cottage garden that we're going to talk more about.
And not only that, of course, the aristocracy back then traveled a lot. And so it was interesting when I was doing some of my research that, you know, from different countries people would come and get ideas. And they, of course, traded a lot of plants and trees, and that was how a lot of horticulture got started. But the interesting thing is the best-known English garden in Europe is not in England.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, it's in Munich, Germany, really.
Seriously.
Yeah. So you can tell that people did travel then, and they have an English garden in Germany.
Well, the formal, traditional English gardens with straight lines and things orderly, I guess that does fit the German cultural aesthetic as well.
Well, yes, and, you know, they were very well traveled back then, and so they not only brought in things from the English gardens, but they would bring in Roman ideas, Chinese pavilion type things, and they, wherever their travels were, they would bring them in and kind of remind them of where they traveled, and they just brought them back to their own gardens.
And so we're obviously not aristocrats as master gardeners, but we travel too, and we travel more as retirees, but everybody travels to a certain extent, whether it's a weekend or a day trip. But this idea of being of visiting gardens and being inspired, this is part of what you learn from the trip too, that this isn't new, that people have been doing this for a really long time.
Yeah, and you know, the 20th century is definitely when the cottage gardens started, and we you know, that's why I like to travel, is I got to pick up some ideas and I'm bringing them home and going to share with everybody here too.
So let's take it down a level now. Let's talk about the specifics of what are the elements of an English garden.
Okay, because there are two different kinds of English gardens. There's the formal, and then there's the cottage.
So should we start with the formal?
Yep, let's start with that. Okay, so usually they're planted with carefully planted short hedges, and they call them ha-has.
Ha-ha.
Yes. And the reason they're short is because they still wanted to be able to keep the animals out from coming onto their property, but they wanted to be able to see the nature over the hedges. So they always put ha-has around, and those were like what we put a small garden gate or a garden fence. They would actually use hedges.
So these weren't gardens in the center of London. These were more gardens on the outlying areas that came up against open space that included farms and
or they could have been, you know, the cottages on the estates. For those of you that remember Downton Abbey, they had people that lived on the estate, and they had houses on the estates, and they still to this day have that same aspect of community. The people that live in some of the towns are actually tenant owners. They work, the landowner owns all the property, owns the houses, and they rent and help still maintain the property. And so those people don't have the big formal gardens, but they have a lot of the smaller gardens, which, you know, incorporates the formal ones would have the kitchen garden and the formal landscaped and the raised flower beds and maybe a little, you know, barn for the cattle and stuff like that. But in the more traditional ones that we're used to, they didn't have all that structure there. But they all have the same things in common, and that would be your perennials, your annuals, your herbs, your roses, shrubs, and grass.
So these are the colors of the palette they used to paint the formal English garden.
And it's really fun because it doesn't, you know, we're even talking about now that we're doing this in January, we have different gardens here. We have different seasons. So you're going to want to put perennials in, and you're going to want to put annuals in, and even winter annuals, which we don't always think of as being a long-term plant, but it brings that flowering element into your garden that you really need to have for a year-round flowering gardens, where the perennials are fine and they come up every year, but the annuals are the really hard workers and the ones that really, you know, keep the color going.
Now, did you see some perennials that you knew what the plants were? Is it all different kinds of plants?
I know. I thought for sure I was going to see a whole bunch of things I didn't know what they were. And even though I'm here coming from Michigan, and there were a lot of plants here in California I didn't know what they were. But when we went to England, a lot of course, those plants were imported into the United States. So there weren't very many that I saw that I couldn't identify. So that was really an interesting thing for me. They had a lot of phlox and hibiscus and hydrangea and lupin and veronica. And, of course, they had tulips, too, which we can't really grow here very well. But they had a wide variety of different kinds of perennials. And they were all ones I could recognize. It was great.
And the annuals?
Annuals, same kind of thing. The ones that I like to plant right now, because it is colder weather, are pansies and cosmos and snapdragons are wonderful. So in the wintertime, this is a really good plant to put in. In the English gardens, when we were there in May, the tulips were just dying. Some of them we just saw the tail end of. But, of course, now they were going to replace those. They were going to let them go die back and then replant those gardens. And in the formal gardens where they had hedges around all the specific kind of gardens, you could see, okay, we have the purple, this whole bed of purple tulips, and now they're going to put in another type of plant in this area. Maybe it was a triangle, maybe it was a rectangle, but they were all different. But they also incorporated vegetables in with their regular flower gardens.
Oh, really? So they don't necessarily have separate vegetable beds? They work them together?
Well, the nice thing is they're using vegetables as a flower or as
So they foliage the...
Yes, yeah. And they do have regular vegetable gardens and because they're actually planting food for their house and for their guests. But mingled in, like chard is a real good example. The colors of chards are just gorgeous. And so they were mixing those in as foliage treatment to accent the flowers that they had.
And I know during the Master Gardener training, a number of the speakers that we had talked about incorporating edibles to perform some of the landscape functions. You know, and we had, I remember the guy that talked about citrus said, you know, your perennial hedges, rather than, you know, relying on escalonia or ficus or something like that, to actually use different types of citrus to create the same benefits, the same landscape purposes of evergreen hedges, but instead also be able to get a food value out of it.
And I did see some, you know, it looked like a raised up hedge because they had trees planted right next to each other, and these were all fruit trees, and they were flat.
Oh, so they hedged them.
Yes.
They used hedgers almost to...
They made the trees look like a raised up hedge. So you had a big long walkway, you saw the trunks, and then you saw all this big green wall of fruit tree.
And so in Orange County, I think Orange County is famous for the ornamental landscape with almost no food values. And this idea, maybe not converting your whole yard to edibles, but, you know, taking this design element that you saw in the English landscapes to bring this in, you could have either informal, soft, unhedged, or formal hedged, depending on what look you're looking for in the garden.
And then one thing that would be remiss in an English garden is to not have roses. And, of course, there were many, many types of roses and different they would have walls, big stone walls that had been there for centuries covered with climbing roses or wisteria, just totally covered. Some of the buildings downtown when we'd go into a town would have wisteria that were just in full bloom, second story high. I mean, we don't see it here because we just don't have buildings that old where people have put that on. But there are a lot of rose producers and growers in England, and so they're very well known for the roses.
So the climbing roses, the hybrid tea roses. Did you see the floribundas that are so popular here in Orange County?
They had everything there. They had all the different kinds of roses. I mean, they would typically in the formal gardens, they would have one of their rooms as rose room, And it's real interesting when you remember the old mazes that you would
walk
through. Well, they actually have hedges that are over 9 feet tall. And you'll walk into a hedge. They'll have a doorway built right into the hedge. Actually, not built. It's just carved out of the hedge. You walk in, and you're walking into a room now, into the formal garden. And this might be the rose garden. Mm-hmm. So they may have little hedges around each of the different types of colors of roses. And, of course, they're all color-coordinated and very well-kept because they have the gardeners.
So we'll get more into the rooms in a second, but I want to finish up on the roses. Were you struck by, in terms of colors and types of roses, being the same amount of variety as what you see in Orange County, or is it more variety?
Yes. No. Matter of fact, because a lot of the roses that were introduced in England, they make their way here. And so the rosarians develop new and better roses, and then they bring them here. And so our large rose companies will actually produce all of these. They graft them onto rootstock here, and then we have them here. So,
of course, you can't bring any live plant material back. There's strict agricultural quarantine requirements with USDA, but the growers are, in fact, going through the required importation process to be able to make these available. So you saw it seemed familiar. The roses seemed familiar to you?
Yes. And, you know, that's the thing. We're talking about travel, and you can bet that people who are interested in a certain type of plant are traveling around the world to find a better plant. So those rose people are out there, too, and they're going to England, and they're going to other countries and looking and at other gardens and seeing which varieties work well, and then they bring them back to us.
And then finishing up the elements of the English garden, the shrubs that you saw.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There were always, and usually they were flowering shrubs so that they actually would bloom at a certain time of the year.
So it's not all privet hedge, which is just, you know, it's not.
No, no. And the great part about that is when they're not blooming, then it leaves a place for your eye to rest. You know, you've got a lot of stuff.
Provides a background
to accentuate
your annuals, your colors.
Yeah.
And then turf, what's going on? It's in terms of UK, England, further north, generally wetter than we are. Are they having drought concerns? Are they replacing turf, or is that still an important part of the English garden?
Not so much. They have a lot of grass. They still keep because they have livestock, they have big open fields where they actually graze. You can look out at when you're in the home, in the garden, you can see the animals grazing on the grass. They also use grass as a fundamental design aspect in the formal gardens, where you will walk in and they will have stepping stones down the center, you know, maybe 2 feet apart. So your eye follows that, but that's how you get through the garden. But everything else is surrounded with grass, and then the hedges, and then the flowers would be in the hedges.
So the design element for English gardens of grass, probably adapted for us here in Orange County, would be maybe accents of lawn and turf, but mm-hmm. maybe less grass, less turf than what you saw in England.
Yeah, grass for us, we really like for our play areas for the kids, and it also makes a nice separate area to enhance your garden.
And I think that gets back to the purpose. You know, why do you have different aspects, different parts of your gardens? What is it accomplishing? Is it providing food? Is it providing visual respite? Or is it have a useful aspect for dogs and for kids? So let's now talk about shapes of English gardens.
Well, there are a lot of shapes for gardens, and typically in the more traditional formal gardens, those have the straight line. So it would always be rectangular rooms, and in those rooms they'll have triangular hedges with flowers inside the hedges, the triangles that the hedges make. So those were straight line tends to make it look more formal. They would also do raised beds, so maybe they would have blocks of stones where an area where they made a raised bed in a certain area, but everything in there would be more formal. They would have a color palette in there, not a cacophony of color. It would just be like these are maybe the yellows and the purples are together.
Right.
So that would be the more formal ones.
So formal would be straight lines, more angular. And again, we're not recommending to our listeners here in Orange County that they install an English garden. But again, so the design element that could be considered is if your hardscaping has lots of straight lines, then playing off of that and including a straight line plant feature might actually make sense. And this would be, of course, based inspired by an English landscape.
Yeah. And some of the characteristics of a more formal garden, especially back in the old estates, they would usually have a lake. They would have rolling lawns. So this would be, you know, we don't have rolling lawns, but they would have mounds, little areas where they would have plantings. And that would be something you could do in your own backyard. Instead of having a giant rolling lawn, you could have a raised area. Maybe you want to highlight a tree in a certain spot and you want to raise up that and put some things you could.
So instead of having a flat rectangular piece of lawn in your yard, the design element from the English gardens that you saw would be to add mounds or add some elevational feature to make it more interesting.
Yeah.
And maybe we can't have a lake in our backyard, but we still can have a water feature.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things you can bring back with you, you know, just even if it's just a little waterfall or just to hear that water is so pleasant to have. And then also they would have groves of trees. We can still do that here in Orange County. I was taking some specialty classes on pruning and grafting, and we found that for your home fruit tree orchard, you don't have to have more than – you can prune them to 6 feet tall. Actually, for the home gardener, a tree that you can pick your fruit in is what – without a ladder is what your goal is.
Right.
So you can have those groves of trees. I have a very small backyard, but I can put 3 fruit trees in it because I am going to prune them to be able to fit my yard.
So when we talk about a grove, we're not thinking about, you know, hundreds of trees. We're thinking about 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 trees, but grouping them to create the design element, the feeling of a larger tree grove.
Well, and besides that, how many oranges can you eat? I mean, if you have an orange tree, I know you're probably
right.
Giving some away. And so they would have large orchards, and, of course, they would, you know, do jams and jellies and things like that to preserve all of their fruit. Well, we don't really have to do that. And you can, like, I'm going to plant 3 avocado trees that bloom in 3 different times in my garden, so I can have avocados all year round.
So you can have an extended season of fruit production without producing so much fruit at one time that you end up wasting it, or worse, you become a pariah in your neighborhood as they see you as they see you coming down the street with a bag of fruit.
Oh, you're Sally again with those avocados.
Avocados are pretty easy to sell,
but
kumquats, lemons, zucchini, whatever it is.
But so you can have your own grove in your backyard. You don't have to have a huge, big, sprawling thing. Another thing that they have are sculptures, and because they traveled a lot and people visited a lot of times, they would bring things from their country, garden items or ideas. Sometimes there would be, they would bring their sculptures or a bust or whatever it was from their country. And so instead of us having big sculptures in our backyard, and I know some people do have them, it's nice, especially if you have a pond or something and you just put a crane in it or something. But I have those real small little critters made out of metal.
Right.
And I just
the ones that kind of rust into a natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some are painted and then they have a nice patina on them. And it kind of brings a little whimsy to the garden. And it's kind of more gives
it's
your
fun.
Garden personality.
I mean, we do our version of garden sculptures, birdhouses. And so one of our family trips, we bought, unpainted birdhouses and bought a bunch of paint. And everybody in our family, young to old, we basically got a birdhouse that we got to decorate, and then I installed those in the backyard.
What a great idea.
So it's a fun thing to do as an activity, but then when the grandkids come over especially, they see their birdhouse, and that's kind of a nice way to get them interested in out in the garden.
Well, and you get birds.
Yeah, and you do get birds, and so there's another benefit to that.
Yeah, that's great.
You talked about ha-ha. Tell me more about ha-ha.
Well, the ha-has were just established so that the farm animals, or not necessarily just farm animals, like we have things to keep coyotes out. Well, they just didn't want the farm animals trampling through all their gardens coming up to the house.
The ha-ha is a type of wall?
Yep. It's they're just a small, short, and it can be a hedge. It could be a bunch of bushes that make a hedge. And it's just so that the animals won't come into the garden. And they just call them, I'm not sure why, but that's what they call them.
How funny.
And then there's also grottos. And the grottos originally in the former gardens were used as romantic hideouts. So, of course, the estates were quite large and pretty formal. And so if you wanted to have a rendezvous, they would have these. They were man-made, and they were supposed to resemble natural caves. Of course, you have rolling lands. There's not always a lot of cave material, but they would make kind of like hidden gardens and places where you could meet discreetly. But I did see some real interesting things. When you had a hedge, they actually built a grotto into the hedge, so they would have a focal point. Maybe it was a sculpture, or maybe it was a window. Sometimes they had windows built right into the hedge, not with wood, but just cut out.
Right.
And it showed into the next garden some focal point that they wanted you to see while you were in this garden room. It was really fun.
So garden room. So let's talk more about garden rooms. So kind of start broad, the concept of garden rooms.
Well, when I moved here from Michigan, I had a much smaller garden space, and mine abuts a canyon with a hill behind it.
Right, so you've got some open space adjacent to your property.
Right, but there's a nice fence there, so I won't get any critters coming in. But the problem was, it was a huge, big rectangle. And it
your yard's a big rectangle.
When I first moved in, it was all grass.
Right.
And then it was a little raised area, and then I had 3 feet of flower garden up to the fence.
Right.
And then there was a cement slab next to the house. And I looked at that, and I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do with all this grass? It's just, it's too much, too much. So what I wound up doing is I wound up building a wall in the center from my house, perpendicular to my house, and separated those two areas in half. So now, on the right-hand side, when I walk out of my dining room, I have the wall with my barbecue on it and a place for buffets or,
so
you know,
kitchen dining area.
Yeah, it's a potluck area I can have out there. So now I have a kitchen that I can cook outside, and then we put a deck with a pergola over the top, and I put my outside dining room.
Okay.
So I have, now I have a kitchen dining room, an outside room for that, and then next to that on the right-hand side is my little formal garden, and that's is going to have my orchard in there. I haven't gotten all my plants bought yet, but that part is going to be when I sit in my dining room, I can look out into my intimate garden, my more formal garden on the right-hand side. Now, as I go on to the other side of the wall, which I can get to from my deck, I have my, I call my Garden of Eden. This is my more informal flower garden.
Right.
This is when I come out of the bedroom in the morning and I just want to sip my coffee and enjoy. I have my rose garden is there, and I have other plants and different, you know, heights and flowering stages. And that's just a fun garden for me to look at and enjoy all the colors, and not so formal, very much more eclectic. And I even have a little river of rocks growing in there with some succulents along there. So that's my more fun area. So I was able to change my big rectangular backyard that I inherited into little houses, little spaces where I could...
Little rooms.
Yeah.
Outdoor rooms.
Outdoor rooms.
With different purposes.
And it was so perfect.
So you got your kitchen, your dining, and then you've got your retreat.
Yes, yes. And my house isn't huge, and so that just extends my living space.
Cool. I'd like to take just a short station break to let you know that you are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org online. This is the In the Garden Show, produced by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I'm Chris Bonner, your host for the hour. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more home garden information, go online or search OC Master Gardener and select the link to the UC Master Gardener program. You'll find out about weeds, pests, ornamental plants, and edibles. This week's topic is lessons learned from English gardens. My guest is Sally Richards, an Orange County Master Gardener. Now let's return to our interview with Sally. So Sally, we were just talking about rooms outside. Now you saw this. Was this a predominant feature to see rooms in English gardens?
Well, when we were visiting the estates, they definitely were more of the formal. Everything was pretty formal there, and we saw a lot of that. However, we did see the Royal Gardens and Prince Charles' home, and we were able to go there and have high tea, which was really fun.
With the prince?
Well, no, we couldn't go when he was there. They wouldn't allow us in when he was there. But he just happened to not be there, and we went. But the thing, his whole philosophy is he really likes the prairie look. He wants to go back to the natural grasslands. And so they actually did have more of a prairie, not so much of regular grass like we think of.
So not either formal English or cottage English, but something altogether different?
Yes. So he had, wherever he could put in that, he actually planted prairie flowers and naturally occurring things, kind of like our native plants here. We're trying to put in native things that grow well here.
For a different ecosystem.
Yes, and that's what he was doing in England.
So the more sustainable, so
yes.
Probably less labor, less fertilizer, everything. You make the investment to put these in and then just kind of let nature support them.
Yes, and, you know, the weeds that we call weeds, you know, still flower and, you know, go to seed and form more different flower areas mixed in with all the other types of flowers that were in that. It was really pretty beautiful.
And so transitions between rooms. So we... one of the things I think you mentioned earlier was pathways.
Yes, and they used all kinds of pathways. They weren't all just, you know, a tile every 12 feet. They had cobblestone. They had brick. The consistent thing is, and we'll talk about architecture and planning your garden, is if they put in cobblestones, they would have cobblestones all the way through it and maybe some we call DG, which is granite.
Which is a common element here in Orange County now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I'm using it especially for my succulents and cactus.
So less runoff, more percolation in the garden. It's good for the yard, good for the environment.
Yep, and good for our water. So they would use different types of pathways to guide you to some quiet area, or they would have a garden that would tee, and then you'd go, whoa, I have to go one way or the other, and they would have a path that leads you in the direction they want you to go. Maybe it's to a quiet seating area.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do that in my backyard too, in my more formal area, is make a little path and then put a little seating thing so that my path actually goes to my seat. And it walks around all of my plants so they can enjoy them on the way to their seeding area.
So the pathways are functional, but they're also a design element that adds, you know, visual interest in the yard.
Yeah, and they really liked these. They wanted to lead you to another place. They didn't want you to just walk through the whole thing. They wanted to have little mysterious places, or especially like the windows in the hedge, which were unexpected. And they put a lot of thought, especially into the formal gardens.
I had a landscape architect design my yard. It's about 8 years ago when we redid our yard. And he included some things I didn't appreciate, but a couple of things that he did a really good job on, this concept of rooms. We've got a dining room with a built-in barbecue. We've got a living room, which has got some outdoor furniture and a fireplace. We've got a small pool, large spa, spool. But one of the things tying into this pathway thing is there's kind of a utilitarian space behind the fireplace that I use just for stuff. And he created a little pathway, which creates kind of this kind of interesting. It's like, oh, there's a path that goes to a secret spot.
Surprise!
Yeah, it's kind of a surprise. People don't even go there, but somehow that does evoke something, make people feel good about when they go out.
Well, and it's a nice little secret that we have, you know, a little secret spot that, you know, not everybody knows about. It's kind of fun. That's why I like having, like, little surprises of maybe little sculptures around. Or I have a couple of those metal flowers that are about 4 feet tall, and I've taken pictures of those and sent them to my friends and said, you know, I use a special fertilizer for this flower, you know, to get this flower to grow, but it's actually metal. And so I like having the fun element and the surprise element in my garden along with all the natural things too.
And we've talked a lot about the formal English gardens. What about the cottage gardens? Give us a little bit of an overview on the cottage gardens.
Well, the cottage gardens, obviously, totally different. They use more curvy lines and a lot of color. So they'll have and all different sizes. They don't just go, okay, now we have to have the short ones in the front and then the mediums and then the talls. They will actually put tall, total tall. It's a total tall garden, and then it kind of flops over onto the pathway. So it's not as restricted or formal. It's, you know, and the perennials are in there, the annuals are in there.
So the formal is more rule-based, but the cottage is just you do different stuff and kind of let it happen?
Well, they actually do plan out the cottage gardens also, and mostly they do it by color. So they want to make sure that it's not going to be, you know, weird looking things going together. So they usually use a color family, like maybe this will be their pinks, reds, and purple area.
Uh-huh.
One of the things about the the cottage gardens is they don't have a whole garden totally full of all different color plants. They usually have a resting space for your eye. So when you have a big group of all these different kinds of plants, then they'll have some greenery next to it so that it kind of gives your eye a break from having all of this color, and then your eye rests, and then they go to another area where they'll have more color.
So the idea of having too much color creates a kind of visual chaos, and the idea of having a palette of different textures and colors of green, and then that really makes the colored flowers pop.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate that instead
right.
of it all kind of blurring together.
It's special when it's, if it was all color, it wouldn't be special and it wouldn't be as interesting and fun to look at.
Yes, and that's one of the things about the English garden. It looks like it's just a whole bunch of messy flowers all over, but actually those are pretty well thought out and color coordinated. So that was always an interesting thing that I found out. And they use a lot of wisteria there in England. It grows really well,
uh-huh.
and that's perfect because it can go right on the walls. Don't have to think of your garden stopping at the house. Now you can have your wisteria growing up the walls, or maybe you have climbing roses. This is a perfect accent for the cottage garden.
Now, you mentioned your little secret area that included seating. So I understand that seating is an important design element in English gardens.
Yes. Well, you know, even in my garden, which is just my backyard, on my path, which goes around to the quiet garden, I have like a half-circle rose garden, and I have a rule on that. They all have to smell good. That's
mm-hmm.
my rule. They don't come in my garden. I don't have that much space, so I have to be particular. So I have a bench right across from that. So the path goes by the garden, but I have a bench so I can sit there and then I can enjoy it, or I can, you know, cut a couple and just enjoy the fragrance of the roses and just be able to have a place to rest and enjoy it.
So being a gardener isn't just all technology and research and facts and figures. It's also getting to know your garden, and just like a relationship with a person, you get to know people and things by spending time with them. So this idea of creating seating areas in the garden gives you a chance to experience, to be with your garden, to get to know it and kind of see stuff that's going on, that if you're just out there taking care of business, you might miss some of this stuff.
And my husband has an interesting philosophy. He's just sort of getting into gardening, and he's really not into it as much as I am. And he goes, well, everything you plant has to grow, or you're not doing something right.
It has to be the right size, fully mature size, right?
Yeah, and they don't die. Your plants don't die. And I said, oh, yes, they do.
I garden by whatever is a good enough plant to live in my garden gets to stay, and the ones that died will try something different.
That's right. It wasn't meant to be there. And so when you're spending your time in the garden, whether you're just pulling on an occasional weed that happened to come up that didn't belong there, or you're sitting there and really enjoying your roses, you start seeing things in there that maybe didn't belong. And if you just were walking by, you might not have noticed it. Or maybe something that just started to grow, and you go, well, how did that get there? Boy, that looks pretty nice.
Yeah.
So those are things that you notice.
The other thing you see is the different vistas and views. And even if most of us don't have view lots, but the idea of sight lines, and being able to take advantage of sight lines beyond your garden. You back up against open space. I do too, but many people don't. But this idea of adding trees and shrubs to block unsightly things, whether it's power lines or a massive wall of a neighbor's house. But on the other hand, not shutting off the views you have, and whether it's open space or even into your neighbor's garden and taking advantage of what you're adjacent to.
Especially if they have a nice flowering tree, you want to enjoy that too. So.
And it sounds like this was an important aspect of a lot of English gardens, was that the garden, the sight lines actually take you beyond the confines of the garden itself.
And especially in the formal ones, they would go on, and then you'd walk into another room, and they'd all be linear, so you'd know there's another room after this room, but there's something else going on. Maybe they had a pond in there. Maybe they had a fountain in that room as their focal point. One of the things that I'm doing here in Orange County is our property backs up to a hill, and they have bushes on the hill, and it's a broom flower, I don't know what the shrub name is, but anyway, it has a yellow flower on it, and the HMO covers all of that. But I have a white fence, and so basically what I want to do now is I've got bougainvillea growing on that, and basically I want to cover my fence with that so that it looks like my garden continues on up the hill into the yellow bushes. So that you don't see it. But now my neighbor, she has those glass panels, and her property looks down into the canyon.
Right.
So she actually has a whole different view and is able to block off, critters and things from coming in her garden, but she can still see
visually
beyond that.
She keeps it open.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend, and he used another way to extend his yard into an open space, and there were some sycamores on the open space property behind him, and what he did is he added some lights on the top of the wall that illuminated the trees that weren't his trees. Well, so then at night when these lights come on, it gives you the impression that he is on the estate, that his property goes further. So you can use tricks, with clear panels, with hedges, with lighting to block or to open up and accentuate and to really just, redefining what a view is. A view isn't just, a view of the ocean or the coast or the whitewater, but a view is just something beyond your yard.
And a lot of our yards aren't really big in some areas, and so all the better. It just makes it look like we have more outdoor space than we actually do.
So some of the do's and don'ts, and again, we have here do's and don'ts in planning your English garden, but these do's and don'ts apply to anybody's garden, too. Mm-hmm. So take us through a few of those, of the do's, Sally.
Okay. The nice thing is these are all things that we can do here.
Whether you have an English garden or not.
Right. But you're going to bring
a
touch of England back here.
A touch of England.
Yes. And so, like I'm doing, I'm making walls. And I'm making walled rooms, so you can do that with yours too. You don't have to actually put up a wall. You could just put a hedge up and make this into a special area. When you're going to do a garden, and this is true of just any type of landscaping, is you want to emulate what your home materials are. So say you have a stone on the outside, maybe you have a stone fireplace or something on the outside. It's good to bring those materials into your garden and incorporate the stones as part of your hardscape.
Rather than doing something completely different.
Yes. Like I've got stucco, which a lot of people do, and I happen to have a little 1-foot wall, and it happens to be stucco, and then I have brick on the top of that to seal it, and so my paths are brick. And so I've incorporated the stucco from the house and then brick. So you're not going to put in brick and stucco and wood and all these different things which are really visually confusing. Bring in the things that will incorporate your house into the garden so it looks like it all is supposed to go
so,
together.
So a more limited palette or consistency in your hardscape materials so that it looks like it goes together. So the kind of the do-it-yourself is, you know, what's on sale at big box store today, and you add that in and you keep doing that, and suddenly you've got this mishmash. And so kind of a simple thing to do is less is more. Just kind of take what you've got that you've already got the investment in and just build off of that.
Yeah, and then it really lets your plants bloom. I mean, really highlights the plants instead of the hardscape.
Right. So hedges and walls to create rooms, and again, not physical rooms, but spaces that have different purposes. And a purpose might be a respite area. It might be for edibles. It might be for entertaining, for dining, for cooking on a barbecue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see. So we talked about emulating the home materials. This concept of, you know, what you plant and how that plays out over the year. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, the backbone of most gardens are your perennials. You can count on those coming up every year at a certain time of the year, and they bloom. But the hard workers for your garden are really your annuals. And so planting a lot of annuals will make your garden continue to have a blooming cycle all year round. So especially in the English gardens, they plant a lot of annuals. They have a lot of perennials, but the same thing here. If you go to the garden centers now, you'll see the winter annuals that are for sale now.
Right.
You aren't going to see those in July because they're not going to be growing. They're just not a good time. So, yeah, put in a lot of annuals.
So plants that change during the year, whether it's blooms or foliage, but this idea of there's always something going on, and something doesn't have to be massive. It doesn't have to be the whole yard. It can just be part of the yard. I mean, I've got some crepe myrtles like a lot of people do, you know, and that provides blooms in the, you know, a couple times of the year, but it also provides, you know, what passes for fall colors here in Southern California. And some years, you know, if we get a little bit of a cold snap like this year, just gorgeous reds, deep reds and oranges. Oh. Some years it's more muted, but you know, again, creating that color for part of the year, you know, it takes the mind off of the fact that I don't have a lot of annuals going on when the crepe myrtles are have a nice foliage color.
And it's a lot of color in one spot, and you're looking up.
Yeah, that's right. Provides a focus.
Yeah.
So plants that change for the year, annuals. Talk about elevation in the garden. Some do's you learn from the English gardens?
Well, you know, they do raised beds, and they don't all necessarily have to be on the outside of your yard, you know, like by the wall. You don't have to have a raised bed there. You can actually make, as your path goes around something, you can make a mound. And you can either put rocks around it to raise it up, depending on what your hardscape choice is. You can actually make rounded areas, or I had a kidney-shaped area in Michigan, and that raised the plants up. So I either had a sitting area, depending on how high your raised area is, and that's really handy when you're weeding. You can just sit down on that and then plant things up to give it a different focal point than just having everything going to the outside
right,
of your
right.
garden.
So just as there's do's, there's don'ts.
Yes.
So what are some don'ts that you picked up on this trip to England?
So, of course, in the formal gardens, we found that, you know, it's the straight lines, it's the rectangles, it's the triangles, hexagons, anything with a straight line leads to a more formal look. And then in the cottage gardens, they would have more curvy lines. So maybe coming from your doorway, you'd have an arch oval or circle coming away from your doorway. So and then you don't want to use mixed flowers in every bed, and we talked about that. We'd like to have...
But going back to the lines, though, I think this is a good one. So okay, whether it's an English garden or not, but the idea of having straight lines or curvy lines.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just like we talked about building materials and tying into the house, if you mix it, it creates, it doesn't make, it doesn't have the same feel as when you've got consistency of lines.
Right.
So the advice here would be don't mix lots of straight lines with lots of curvy lines. Pick what you're going to go with. And again, you are going to have things that have straight lines like the driveway, but then you can add a curvy element of inset stones or paver materials to create a curve. So you can add curves to some of the straight line features if you're looking for that less formal. If you're looking for a more formal look, stay away from the curviness. Maybe some circles work, but basically stay with the geometric shapes.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm doing, because I do have my rectangular concrete sidewalk just before I get into my garden and I want it to be more informal, I'm going to take bricks and make a kind of an alcove, but it's going to be a half circle from my concrete so that I can plant either a small tree or some type of a highlighted thing there, so it breaks up that straight line of the cement there.
Got it.
And then I'll have space on the other side in my garden to plant other plants.
Now, you started to talk about mixing flowers. I interrupted you, so go ahead with that thought now.
Well, you know, we talked about this a little earlier about having all of the different colors, and too much color just doesn't let your eye rest, doesn't let you be calm. Planting things in where you've got different heights or maybe all the same height but flopping over, especially in your cottage garden.
Right.
But you need to have that break, and it can be either a seating area or you can have greenery there. And a lot of times greenery doesn't have to be green either. When your roses start to come out, you always get those red.
The fresh growth.
Right. And so, they're not flowering. There's no color there. There's just the green and the reds. And there are a lot of plants, especially this time of year when it starts to get cold, they do start to turn red and get different colors. So you don't just have to have like a hedge type of thing. But, you know, even the hydrangeas only bloom at a certain time of the year. And so when they're not blooming, they have beautiful big leaves on them. And it's really nice.
So in the flower beds, don't mix the flowers, but try to create an impact of a certain color. I think, you know, people don't think of Disneyland as being, you know, formal gardens. But if you really look at it, again, they're not cottage gardens. They are more formal gardens. And one of the things that they do very effectively is when they do a bed, they do a color, and it creates this huge splash of the same color. And you know, I do this on a small scale in my own garden where, you know, my front flowering bed, I seasonally switch that out. I tend to go towards the pinks, but, you know, in Christmas time I'll put out whites. But but I'll put in all the same colored flowers rather than mixing it up, because it creates visually a bigger impact when you don't mix and match the colors together in the same bed.
Yeah, and they do a great job with topiaries too.
So focal points, what's a focal point?
Okay, so a focal point could be a bird bath.
Okay.
It could be a small fountain. Maybe you have a little fountain.
So what's the don't here?
Okay, so if you have too many, yes, you like birds, and I have a bird bath in here, and I'm going to put a fountain nearby because I think the birds would like to have that fountain. And then I have a couple of statues that I'd like to put in there too, but maybe I only have like a 6 by 6 foot space, but I really like these, or I picked up this, and somebody gave me this, and then pretty soon it gets to be very cluttered, and you don't really get to enjoy it. It's better to choose one or two things to concentrate, to focus on.
It's more meaningful. It's more visually interesting. It's better design if your garden doesn't look cluttered with focal points.
Yes, and it's fun to have whimsy and surprise, but when you're sitting there and pretty soon you start collecting, and then you have way too much going on, and then you lose the whole point of a garden, is you really want to enjoy the flowers.
Let's finish up on seating. We talked about seating earlier. So give our listeners some ideas and perspectives about seating that you got from your trip.
Well, the nice thing was they were like surprise seating. Like they had the path, and it didn't go anywhere except to this seating area. So you are walking through this garden, and all of a sudden the path goes off to the left, and you don't see it because maybe there's a hedge there. And then all of a sudden you come on this little bench, and it's got flowers around it. Or maybe there's an arbor over the bench where you can enjoy the climbing roses. It just is a nice little place for you to stop and reflect. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, I have a little aluminum chair that I have that's a really nice aluminum chair that I have outside, and a little table. That's my seating area when I just want to sit in my garden.
So this doesn't have to be hardscape, expensive, complex.
No.
When we're talking about seating areas.
Yeah, and then on my in my rose garden across from that, I just have a flat old wooden bench that I found, and somebody, it was recycled, and I said, wow, that'll be perfect because it's just wood and it's not ornate, it's not anything, it's just a place to sit.
So seating is something that almost everybody can add to the garden to add visual interest, to add enjoyment, and to be able just to be out in your garden and enjoy it more.
And it, when you're in your garden too, walk to a different part of your garden. Like I have a large area where I can walk into it, and right now I have it kind of looking as an overview of a field with a lot of ground cover, and granted this isn't very big, but when I walk to the back of the garden and I look back, it's a completely different view than when I'm standing on my cement slab looking at my garden. And so it's nice to have those little walkways with a little seating area in a surprise area to give you a different perspective on your garden.
So the lessons learned in terms of all the things we've talked about, but another lesson learned, not specific to your trip, but just in general, is the idea of building into your travels, you know, whether it's day trips here in Southern California or more distant trips to other parts of California or even to the world, is to look for these gardens, look for these tours, look for these garden shows to get fun, interesting, inspirational ideas that you can bring back to your garden.
And that's exactly what I did. There were just so many different things that I saw and was able to bring them back here to Southern California. And it was a wonderful trip.
We've come to the close of our show, In the Garden. You've been listening to an interview with Sally Richards, an Orange County Master Gardener. Thank you, Sally, for sharing your knowledge and insights with us.
Oh, thanks. This was fun, Chris.
Yeah, it was. Remember, gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. Thank you for listening to KUCI 88.9 FM, In the Garden Show. Tune in every week, Thursdays 8:30 to 9:30.